he's also the coordinator of the European project called QUIC, which is about the foundational structure of quantum information and computation. And also the guy was involved in this project. This project is going to finish with a great success. Right.
Yes.
And I think he's working on somehow making with the new generation of the logic or tool to analyze quantum information in somehow turning around conventional plan set notation by Dirac. So you have kind of the new formally. And today he's talking about the compositional structure of much part identifying.
Yeah, thank you. So
it won't come as a surprise that there will be some category theory here, although I'm gonna be really slow and really to the point of the particular goal, which is like to give a compositional paradigm for general multi-partite quantum entanglement. So please interrupt me when something is not clear. I'm going to do parts of this talk on the whiteboard just to force myself to be slow, to be really slow, and because it's easy to sort of rush over these things. So the first thing I'm going to start with is this paradigm, SLOCC, who some of you might know, some of you might not know, but it's a paradigm to compare different modes of entanglement. If you're looking at quantum entanglement, what you're interested in is that bit, well, I shouldn't use bit, that piece which is not local because you're interested in entanglement and which is not sort of classical. So you want to look for something which is generally quantum. And typically what people do is to classify entanglements by means of comparing certain states. So you say that two multipartite states compare, meaning one is more entangled in a certain sense than another. Not in a quantitative way, but just that he has more of something. Whenever by possibly probabilistic, either local or classical means, one can be turned into the other. So then you would obviously say that two states are SLOCC, because that comes from stochastic local operations and classical communication. That's what SLOCC stands for. So they're slot equivalent if one can be turned to the other and vice versa. And then, fortunately, there is a very simple characterization of that. It basically turns down that with local invertible linear maps, you can actually turn one state into another, which is a very simple formal kind of paradigm. Fortunately, it's easier than having to think about all those things. So that's basically what we are interested here. Multipartite quantum states, which in one way or another, by means of local invertible linear maps, you can turn into one another. And people have been studying this. And if you look at two qubits, then the situation is very simple. You just got sort of two levels. Because what can you have for a linear map? Well, if you take two qubit entangled states, and I'm going to start to introduce, well, many people here have seen this kind of notation, so I think of a two qubit state as something like this. It has two outputs on which I can act, right? So here you got a qubit, and there you got a qubit, right? And typically, by Choi Jamolkovsky style argument, you know that this is encoded by a linear function, right? Huh? So the usual way I would actually depict this would be like this. But here you got a linear function. That would be the Bell state. And in this way, you can basically realize any bipartite state, right? Now, what are the possibilities for this linear function? It's either invertible or not. So these are these two dots. Yeah, invertible, non-invertible. And this then means that the thing is completely disentangled, right? Now, this clear, yeah? Now, the situation for three qubits is a little bit more interesting and significantly less trivial to show. So this is, again, the completely disentangled state. Then you got three levels where two out of your three qubits are entangled to each other. And the third one is disentangled from the rest. But then the really interesting thing is that you don't get an upper bound. Well, you don't get a unique supremum. There is no such thing as a maximally entangled situation. There is two guys there. One of them is called the GHZ state, and the other one is called the W state. And I think this was this was established by, I think, Dur, Chirac, Strata, somewhere early in this millennium. And this sort of seems to give some promise that you might be able to classify all multipartite entanglements. But the thing is, once you go beyond these guys, so here, I'll just, then things is a complete mess. I think anybody who works in this area probably will agree that the moment you go to 4 qubits, things is just, the situation is just horrible. You've got a continuous class of these kinds of entanglements. People have come up with some schemes, but there is no structural understanding whatsoever. So hence, there is no real thing you can do with these huge amount of multipartite sets because you just don't have any grasp on its structural understanding. Now, what I'm going to most of this talk will be about studying these two guys. And then the rest will be an indication that by really understanding these two, you might actually understand all of this too. And that's going to be kind of the message of this talk. You might believe it or not, but I'm going to try to provide some arguments of that. But so the first thing to do will be to really understand these two guys. So these two guys, the GHZ state and the W state, are these two points. We want to understand that, well, they look like, well, there's two things, and at first there doesn't seem to be much similarity between them. But so basically, this talk, the goal will be to show that these two guys have a lot in common, almost everything, but to see this, I have to sort of put them in a different shape. And they actually have a tiny bit of difference only, and that will be a purely topological difference. First, I have to put them in the right shape so that you see that they're actually extremely similar. And then I have to show you where there actually is a tiny difference. So the idea would be then that in some funny way, by composing these two guys, this GHZ and this W, so I have to explain what composition of such guys is, of course, otherwise it doesn't mean anything, that you can actually, what we think is essentially generate all multipartite entanglements, one way. Of course, what you mean by essentially is partly defined by the way you do it, but I think we have a good case, a reasonable case there. And the fact that this will all be within a sort of discrete calculus will mean that this supports automation. We got software tools. We are developing software tools in which you could actually plug this calculus, and maybe someday this thing comes up with a new physics result. That would be really cool, a piece of software which proves a physics result. So this kind of structure would support such a program. Another thing which I will show is, well, we get a new quantum structural paradigm and graphical calculus which assume complementary observables. Some people who've seen previous talks by myself or Ross Duncan, they might have seen things with red and green dots and stuff like that. So this is our sort of abstract way to deal with complementarity. What we are going to show is that the thing I'm going to talk about today, from that you construct complementary observables. So it seems to be structurally more fundamental. And then the kind of foundational wild claim one could make is that this GHZ-W duality could be more fundamental than complementarity because it's structurally more powerful. Maybe. Definitely in the sense I'm gonna present it. It's structured because I can construct one from the other, and I can't do it the other way around. I can't build GHZ-W structures from a pair of complementary observables, but I can build a pair of complementary observables from GHZ-W structures. It's kind of nice little thingy, and we don't know yet how far this is going to bring us. Okay, I'm now going to... So like I said, interrupt me if something is not clear. So I'm just going to start studying this guy, this GHZ state. So I'm introducing this notation here. You see, you see these three wires coming out. Just think of these as three qubits on which you can act. And they are in some way connected, which I represent by this dot. They are not separate or something like that, right? So it's just a notation. And we will study this state. So one of the things we know about this state is that there is a certain symmetry. In that, if I exchange the first and the second qubit, then I get the same state, right? You see, it's perfectly symmetric. So in my notation, so I'm going to introduce a swap operation, and if I apply this to this guy, then I get this guy back, right? Huh? So I introduce new slight little concept here. You see, this is just a swapper. So I, J is mapped to J, I. Another property I've got for this guy is that I can reduce it in a certain manner. If I take it and I stick, this is going to be an effect. I use this notation here. I'll put it in a box again, a new notation to denote a certain effect, and the effect will be the plus state. If I stick in the plus state on the first qubit, then I get the Bell state, right? I get the Bell state. Well, you can just do that. So this is going to be my notation. So I'm just throwing lots of notation at you, but there is like a logic to the system. Oh, you get the Bell state. And we know that this Bell state satisfies that if you take it and you compose it with something else, which you get the identity. So here is this Bell state. And what is this? This is actually the Bell effect, which is like 0, 0, plus 1, 1, right? This is something, this is like the idea of teleportation. If you get a Bell state and you have it like this, you got an incoming qubit, you act on it with a Bell effect, then the overall effect is an identity, just your teleportation type. See? Yeah? No. So I'm just writing down a bunch of properties of this guy. It's very naive, nothing fancy here. I'm just looking there and I see, what can I read from this structure? And this is stuff I can read. I can swap this first. It may seem very random that I just come up with these guys, but there is, of course, a reason that I'm doing this. So this is going to stay for a while, and then you'll see later that it actually perfectly matches something else. But at the moment, I'm just writing down stuff about that state. Like, if I stick in the plus state here, if I project on the plus state, I get something out, which we know, which is the Bell state. And for the Bell state, we have this particular property. So that's one. Trace. So, tree. Trace. This is a slightly more complicated one. If I take this guy, and this will be the most important of everything I write down. If I take this guy, and then I take this one, which I will define. Again, it's a new picture, so I have to define it. This will be zero, the effect, like the GHZ effect. And now I'm going to use this bit to stick up here. And it's very easy. You can check, actually, that what I'm doing here is actually nothing but a trace. This is actually the trace, something you can easily check. Right. And if I do this, then you get identity. That's sort of no thing if you take the GHZ state and you trace out I have to trace out more. This doesn't type check otherwise, of course. I trace out two of these guys, of course. So that's again a typical property of GHZ state. And then the fourth one I'm going to call flip, because I couldn't come up with a better name. I take this guy, GHZ state, and now I'm going to take all this. And what I get is the one which I wrote down. So that's just a bunch of properties of the GHZ state. I'm going to add, so this is 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm just going to add one thing at this stage. So we can actually generate other states with the GHZ state by composing them. What do I mean? If I take such a G, I'm going to call this compose. If I take such a GHZ state, and I take another one, and I now cap it off with the guy introduced here, then I will get something new, which I write like this. And this will then be, so I generate the new, so you see by combining all this data, I can actually build bigger things and so on. Okay, this is the GHZ state. These are a bunch of properties of GHZ state. Now let's see what we can say about the W state. Right. Do similar things hold? Well, one is exactly the same. Okay, we find something common. So this is the same for W. Turns out 4 is also the same. Because basically, you see you're just transposing here. Huh? And basically what this means is that the transpose of a cat is the same as its bra, as its corresponding bra. The transpose is equal to the adjoint. That's what this last one says. And which basically boils down to the fact that all your coefficients are real. This one basically says that your coefficients are real here. So it's true in both cases. So these are not very interesting ones. Same. What else do we have? This one. Do we have something like this for the W state? Yeah, actually we do. We do. But we have to sort of change the data a little bit. So my W is now by thick, full dot, as compared to the open one. So that's my slight change of notation. I take this guy, and now I have to take this one to be 0. I take this one to be 0, and I get, again, something like this. But this again, this now is not the Bell state. This is not the Bell state. This is 0, 1 plus 1, 0. But I can take a corresponding thing like I did there, stick it here, then stick something there, and get the identity. But in this case, this has now to be, the corresponding cat, the corresponding bra, 0, 1, plus 1, 0, right? What's the significance of? Oh, because it's a different state. I'm just distinguishing between all those data for the THZ and all the data for the W by to make a difference. But so what I'm mainly working towards making it look all the same. Right? Like this property is the same in both cases, so it suffices that I just have to change the data. I have to say the single dot here thingy is different from the open. Closed cup is different from the. So I have to change a couple of words to make full comparison there. Okay, now the big difference is going to be here in number 3. 3 is going to be the major difference. So I can make this picture again because now I can build something like my trace because I've got my cups, I got everything. I make this guy, I take this guy, I do this. These are now full dots, but actually, you know, because of the cyclicity of the trace, it actually doesn't really matter. This is again the trace. This is actually again the trace, independent of the fact that you get different dots. Here is the big deal difference. It's going to look at first a bit complicated. Here you get nothing, there you got an identity, and here you get something disconnected. And I'm going to denote this for now. Not just like this, because it turns out to be not the same as this. And this is not, so I'm going to give a different notation, I'm going to put a circle there. They should not touch. And there's a good reason I take this notation. Because it turns out that you can, so this is valid, I'm not going to prove this, but this is a valid equation for the W state, provided that this one you pick to be 0, and this one you pick to be 1. So, right. This has to be this. appears to be the same. Right? And you see it's different than this is zero, and this is my notation for one. It's a bit different. So don't get, this is like a big circle. This is like a dot with a circle around. Now the reason I do it like that is because in fact this will turn out to be equal to something we will introduce later, which looks like this. But I'll get back to that. So there is a good reason to do that. Right, so this is, yeah, okay, you can again do some composition here. You can do this game of composing too here. And it turns out if you now take the full dot, if you put the full dot in the middle rather than the open dot, then you get sort of the natural generalization of W. But you have to put this different dot here to combine, otherwise it doesn't work. Yeah?
The new notation with the dot and the circle on it.
That's still a mystery. But
what's surprising me is that you've defined the upside down one not to be the dagger of the right side up one.
Ah.
Okay, so you're going to get to that.
That's what killed us for more than a year. Indeed. So that's what you counterintuitive for whatever we have been doing before. Indeed. That was a crucial insight.
Okay, yeah? Guys. This set of properties doesn't specify GHZ state uniquely.
What?
This set of properties.
Ah, I'll get back to that. That's the kind of results, of course, which we want to show. That's the kind of results, yeah, very close, actually, yes.
Okay. Yeah. On equation 3, this is taking the partial trace of...
On two of three systems.
Two of three systems, okay. And so what is the density operator that one gets? So this is just a statement that the density operator is different than the...
So here the density operator is left. You get the identity.
Okay, and here you get...
And here you get something which is disconnected. However, it's not really a density operator.
Yeah, but originally...
This is not the end... What?
No, I think that we can calculate the reduced density matrix for the W set, and this is just the unbiased.
Yeah. But actually, I didn't say what this was. You're right. I didn't say what this was. But you see, here, I tell you what it is. I did say what it is. It's here. But these guys are now not the Bell state. They're 0, 1, 1, 0. So they actually swap zeros and 1. When I flip, so this equation here, holds at this side, but with this guy, which flips zeros and ones. Let me say explicitly what this is. This is not Braque 001, but it's Braque 110 plus 101 plus 0, 1, 0, 1, 1. Yeah? So it's not the edge of this, and that's why this is not a density matrix. And it's sort of the obvious thing. Zeros and in this one, zeros and ones are flipped relative to there.
So I'm confused. You took the partial trace.
I take the partial. This is the partial trace.
Starting from a density matrix.
No. Starting from like just using something like this, and then something else. I'm going to just as notation use this, and this is the W state. Well, I should actually call it W, and this is the W state in which I swap the zeros and the ones in the entities. So that's the matrix. And the reason I do this is because you see, if I go from this one to this one, I'm not just transposing with the Bell state, but I'm doing it with this one, with the 0, 1, 1, 0 state, which swaps zeros and ones. So it's something you wouldn't naturally do. Like, it's not like something you would do in your standard. But I'm just pointing here at a bunch of correspondences, which if you use this funny cap, just makes these two tables very similar, with the exception of this number 3, where here, you see, if I take the trace, then I get a picture which is connected. Otherwise, this side,
I get a picture where this, which is disconnect, which is a fundamental difference, like very radical difference. This is like something separable and then something not separable. But otherwise, all these pictures are the same. And it's indeed that these things are effectively going to characterize GNT and W. Now, at the moment, this looks as a very set of random stuff. It's not very pretty. So the goal is now to show you that all this random stuff is actually a very simple algebraic structure if you sort of put it in the right manner. And that's what we're going to do now, show that the things which you see at these two sides are actually a pretty algebraic structure, which you might not, doesn't look at all like it, but okay. Some people might get a hunch. For the people who have been looking at this stuff and even working it like Rob, they never find this very counterintuitive. It's everything you learn is wrong. Kind of stuff. Okay, community Frobenius algebra. That's like the. It's a piece of algebra which you these days see popping up everywhere, like in knot
theory, in topological quantum field theory. It's all full of things which are called Frobenius algebras, and people are sort of discovering them anywhere now. Anywhere you look, you see a Frobenius algebra. It's sort of a new thing in math, and these guys are actually examples from it, if you put it in the right manner. So let me do a pedestrian introduction here. So a commutative monoid, is like the simplest way to say it's a group without units. So you take a group, so you got a multiplication on a set, which is associative, commutative, and which got a unit. Well, that's what is called a monoid. So it's all the group axioms, but then without having a unit. Now, what? One is the
unit. Without inverse.
Yeah.
Without the inverse.
Without inverse, sorry. Okay, so inverse, I mean. Sorry. Group without the inverse, right. So, now I'm going to write this a little bit different. I'm just going to change notation. Rather than writing with dot, I'm going to say there is some sort of binary function with two inputs, and which then satisfies these equations, which is exactly the same as saying this.
Right? Exactly the same. Now, why am I doing this? Because I want to formulate all of this in a manner where I don't see these A, B, and C's anymore. I want to have three equations between functions here rather than something which takes values on points. And then the way to do this is as follows. So you see, for example, commutativity, saying that mu from A and B equals mu B A is the same as saying that mu is equal to mu after swapping. Right? So this sigma here is actually in a picture exactly the thing I've been sort of writing here. I swap my two inputs. So the function mu is equal to mu after I sort of swap the inputs. That's commutativity, right? And now I also, like my unit, I have to write it as a function. And I write it as a function which takes some element of a singleton, which I denote star, to the unit element in my set. Then I can take the Cartesian product of the identity and this. I apply it, and then I get identity. So you see that this is an associativity. Then again, I apply an identity on my third thing, and I apply my mu to my first and my second. It's the same as applying my identity to my first, mu to my second and third, and then again. Yeah?
I'm confused by the notation because since mu acts already on the Cartesian product of A and A, the identity E is the identity in A, so you should write 1A times 1A. I'm slightly confused. This E...
You're looking at this one?
Yeah. So it's convenient to distinguish E from 1A.
So E
only if mu acts on A cross B.
So A. This is sets. Huh? So I've got two sets here.
Well,
so mu acts on a Cartesian product of sets, right?
Yeah, but then why you want to distinguish E from 1A?
One A means the identity on A. It goes from A to A.
And B?
What?
And what is E?
Little E goes from a singleton to A.
He introduces the identity.
There is a confusion in the use of the number of uses of the symbol one. So let me put this one up. So, right. Yeah, I didn't realize, but I see where you're going. So my 1A is just the identity from A to A, while E goes from some singleton to A, and it maps this thing on my unit of my unit for my monoid, right? Mm-hmm. So what mu gets as input is whatever came in here, so it's just the identity, and then this guy one. So it's it's just notation. The whole point is that I want to write this thing down without any reference to elements, and that's what I achieve here. And the reason you want to do this is to make a funny definition, which is exactly the same, but my name, I just put a code in front, but I just swapped everything up, I swapped everything around. So instead of from A times A to A, we go from A to A times A. Instead of, you see, this equation, I just swap the order of everything. I swap the order relative to composition. So instead of my sigma there on the right, now it's on the left. You see, just the order has changed everywhere. And what I used to call commutative, I now call co-commutative. What I used to call associative, I call co-associative. What I used to call unital, I call co-unital. So everything is code. I can do this. I couldn't have done this if there was still this reference to point, of course. But this is the definition. It's a perfectly legal definition. Now, of course, this kind of thing you've seen a million times in your life. Groups are examples of that, the Lenin's vectors. Whatever algebraic structure you see involves binary operations which are associative and sometimes commutative. This stuff you've never seen. Why? There's a good reason why you've never seen that. Let me go to an example. So, here is an example. No, wait, shouldn't do this. Let me just stick here. The reason you haven't seen them, let me just say this,
is because there aren't any interesting ones. There is actually only one for each set, it turns out. And what it does is it takes the element and just copies it. That's the only one which exists. So it's not an interesting concept, because there is only one. So you can't say, given a co-commutative monoid on a set, it's not interesting, because there is only one. So there's nothing to learn from it. Now, things become more interesting if actually, rather than saying, this is a set and this is the Cartesian product, that you say, well, this is any kind of mathematical structure, and there is any kind of way of combining them, which basically boils down to saying these are morphisms in some monoidal category, which is maybe a little bit heavy on the tail, but then things become interesting. And to give you one simple example, if instead of this being a function, we allow this thing to be a relation, while even still the Cartesian product there, then there are many interesting ones. You see why?
Can be many to one.
Yeah, but because a relation has a converse. Every relation has a converse, and for each guy of this sort, there's a guy of this sort just by form.
Yeah.
But just taking the converse.
Well, then
this
becomes many to one.
You can have nothing. You don't have to be total. Yeah. But then there are as many of these as there are of these.
Yeah.
For each one of these, there is one of these. If you just move to relations, and basically, so what we do here is you can actually go to linear maps too. Let this be a linear map and let this be the tensor product. And those are the kind of guys we're going to be interested in here. Exactly the same definition, but instead of plugging in
the Cartesian product, you plug the tensor product. Instead of asking this to be a function, you ask this to be a linear map. And you get a bunch of stuff. It's a definition. You got one of these, you got one of these. Two definitions. Right? This is my graphical notation, which is a bit similar to that. I'm denoting now something which has two inputs and one output just by this. Two inputs and one output. And you see my dots already emerging. And a unit would have zero inputs and one output. So I denote it like this. And this is, for example, my swapping axiom. If I swap the inputs, then I get the same thing if I don't. And this is associativity. And similar pictures arise when you took the and that's just actually the same pictures, everything upside down, right? Okay, so now let me, already did these examples. Just a couple of examples of these guys in Hilbert space. So something like this could be just something which copies. If you take a basis and you just copy the basis elements, you get one of these commonoids. So that's a copying operation. It's an interesting operation from a quantum mechanical perspective. In fact, such an operation captures a basis because by the no-cloning theorem, the only things you can copy are basis elements. And if you take the adjoint, you get one of those guys. So from here to there, it's just adjoints. For each one here, you find one there. So here is another one, which is like conjunction. I just made the conjunctions on the basis. And this would be the adjoint of the same thing. So there's many of these guys. So you can ask yourself, what are the interesting ones? And there is the following thing you can show. That so when I say in F-Hilp, I just mean everything applies to Hilbert spaces and tensor product and linear maps. That's what it means. So you actually don't have to know about categories for this one. Then special commutative Frobenius algebras. Now the word Frobenius algebras comes, which is the stuff which we've been seeing before with these two additional equations. Like, this means you take this co-multiplication and you post-compose it with this multiplication and you get identity. So you assume now that you've got a pair of these guys, one of the ones which is the regular monoid, one of the ones upside down. We allow these things to live in Hilbert spaces, being linear map with tensor product. And if you then add these two conditions, which is how this one interacts with this one, how these two guys interact, then it turns out that they are exactly in correspondence with bases in your Hilbert space. So whenever you got a basis, then you just define the operator. It doesn't have to be an orthonormal basis, by the way. It can be not normalized, not orthogonal. Whenever you copy your basis vectors, then you get one of these guys. And those are the only ones there are. There are no other ones. So it's a fairly strong theorem. You can't. So these equations, together with these equations, they characterize orthonormal bases, which is funny because we don't say anything about summation or anything like that. But you can show this, that these are exactly orthonormal bases. And once, you know, once we are getting at characterizing a basis, then you see we're close to characterizing a GHZ state. Because what is a GHZ state? It's very much the same as a basis, actually. If I've got a basis, then I write a GHZ state as. So, if I've got a basis, like E0, E1, say, and I write E0 plus E1, well, this is a GHZ state. This will always be slog equivalent, at least, to a GHZ state, because I can just do a change of basis to 0 and 1, and I've got a GHZ state. So you see, we're coming in the direction. And you see, the pictures are becoming somewhat similar with what we had before. So now we have to make this a little bit stronger, this correspondence.
So these axioms above imply the existence of a basis.
So what you mean by basis? First, let me formulate it differently. If you give me a basis, and I make this linear map, which copies a basis vector, right?
Yes.
Which then I extend it by linearity. This extends to a linear map.
So you don't demand that I give you an orthonormal basis. I can give you a
any basis is okay. That's the thing. Any basis is okay.
Okay, and you define a linear map and then you extend it.
And then this one can be extended with an appropriate multiplication, which is uniquely defined into such a structure.
Okay.
Vice versa. But that's quite simple to show. It's very simple to see with orthonormal basis because then the other guy is just the adjoint. If it's not orthonormal, it's a little bit more subtle, but it's quite easy to establish. But the harder side is that anything which satisfies these axioms arises in this manner. That's the sort of more powerful side of the statement, that you really have an axiomatization in these terms of an arbitrary basis. You see, we're giving this talk before, but then I always talk about a normal basis. Because then I ask for this guy to be the actual of this guy. That's what I'm sort of not saying now.
To convert from special CFA to this form, you have to identify something, right? Because
The way you prove this is you really go to Gelfand representation of C star of Brass. That's the kind of thing you do. The way you do this is, this is a given thing, and you look at the points which are copied. Which points are sent to a pair. That's actually how you go from here to there. That's how you do it.
So the proof concludes there must be such a point, and that...
You have to show that these things exist, and. So but that's the Gelfand spectrum, that's that for you. So
now we have understood this algebraic structure, and the punchline, of course, is going to be that this kind of algebraic structure, consisting of such a monoid and a comonoid, which interact in a certain way, will in some way be related to all the stuff you see in the board on the left and the right. And so here, GHZ and W, algebraic similarity and topological difference. So let me just say how I go from the things you've seen before, this copying and this multiplication and this co-multiplication, to stuff like here. Well, you see, if I got a bunch of this co-multiplication and I stick this dot in here, then I get something like a tripartite state, right? Yeah? So I can use these guys and compose them in a way that I got three outputs. Now, I could compose them in different ways, of course, but here is an example of composing that I get this one, and with the upside down guys, I can get this one, right? In the other way around, which is a little bit more complicated, if I've got a GHZ state here, say, or any tripartite state, which I now represent, not to make the confusion, without dots. I'm just representing it as something with three outputs, just to avoid the confusion with the dot notation of before. Then I do the following. I'm going to look for something of this kind, which is like a tripartite effect, which satisfies this equation, which is I take my tripartite state and I assume it comes with a special little effect. So as part of what I call a GHZ state, I assume, whatever tripartite, I always assume it comes with something like a unit, which will be something I can sort of cup it up with. See the kind of thing which I was introducing here. I just assume it's given. You can actually show that sort of, in a certain extent, in linear algebra, Hilbert space is uniquely defined. Because if you got a monoid, I don't know whether you know this, if you got a monoid, its unit is always uniquely defined. You can't have two. If you got two units, they must be the same. So it's not something you got a lot of freedom. Assume given this and this, and then you look for such a guy which satisfies this equation, then you can actually build one of these, and you can build one of these. It's a sort of complicated, maybe at first sight, but this is actually how you establish the following theorem. A special commutative for B algebra on a qubit, like on two-dimensional Hilbert space, induces a GHZ class state. So if I build from any of these commutative Frobenius algebras a tripartite state like that, then it will always be a GHZ class state. Always. Provided I require this condition in addition. And vice versa. That's actually the strongest side, and vice versa. Each symmetric GHZ slog, this is always slog class state, arises in this manner. Or, in other words, if I do this, I always get one of these Frobenius algebras. Now, this is the other one. We introduce this word anti-special for this equation. An anti-special commutative Frobenius algebra, so this is now this instead of this equation, induces a symmetric W class state and vice versa. So W class, as a LOCC, is exactly the same as these commutative Frobenius algebras I've been describing, plus this equation. GHZ state is exactly the same as this commutative Frobenius algebras, subject to this equation. So if I hide these two, then this is the common structure of GHZ and W. If I add them, then this is what separates them. And you see, it's a very funny condition. It's if you see a loop, whether it actually can be thrown away, or whether it splits up in two loops. Now I can also explain to you what these guys were. So I said, I'll leave it a little bit as a mystery what this is, but this is actually nothing but... So you take, for example, such a co-multiplication, And if you then have a multiplication, and I take the unit of this and I stick it in here, then I get something like a cup. And if I stick this cup on here, that's actually what I meant by this and this. So you sort of build them. At the time, it was complicated. But now, it doesn't go as a surprise that all the equations which you see here, except for the bottom one, all the equations which you see here, and all the equations which you see there, they turn out to be completely equivalent with the one which I've been assuming so far, namely these. Which then, wait, let me stick here. So these are exactly equivalent, it turns out, to all of these except for this one. This one is different. You see here, if you look good, you see that there is sort of a loop here in the middle. You see this? There's a loop in the middle. Yeah? There's like a closed thing in the middle. And this actually boils down to this equation. See, if I sort of take this one, if I take this one, and rather than going down like this, I just go immediately up, then you see that you get this guy. So it's exact. So what I was trying to do there was actually showing that these special properties are what you. Now I've written something down here that every commutative Frobenius algebra on a qubit is always either special or anti-special. So these are not random conditions. These are turn out to be the only one you can have. So which is sort of nice. The way we proved this was not by doing some algebra, but was going to the classification of tripartite state papers and use that result and drag it back into the algebra. So this is sort of an algebraic representation result which follows from a classification result of tripartite entanglement. It's kind of cute. What? We need symmetric, we need symmetric just because of the algebra sort of as it built in, because of the commutativity. And otherwise, you can't just throw away commutativity, then it becomes a mess. But on the other hand, what you can show is that locally, so the other result is that you can take any GHZ, or you cannot take any tripartite state, and then by local operation, it can always be sort of, yeah. So but there is only, these are very, very radically separating properties, these two. They're very radically separating. And actually, it goes as far as every monoid can be extended to one. So it's a very strong algebraic characterization of whatever you can have on a qubit. It's quite powerful, yeah. Yeah, I'm not going to go into that. I don't know, so some people here might have seen me. I've only got 5 minutes left, so. Some people have seen me talking about spider theorems and stuff like that before. So, and typically, spider theorems was the sort of thing we showed for Dagger. So compact Frobenius algebras and Dagger commutative Frobenius algebras. Now it turns out that if you have these axioms here, what it tells you is that any configuration you can build with all these dot structures, forget about this one for now, every configuration you can build with using these dots and plugging things together can always be reduced to the following form. So it means it actually only depends on the number of inputs, the number of outputs, and the number of loops in it. So you see, here you see a picture. Here you see a picture, right? According to this theorem, I see one input, I see one output, and I see one hole in the middle. So it's going to be equal to just taking two inputs, one hole in the middle, and two outputs. What? Oh, they're connected up. These are just more holes. This is just, so basically you count the number of inputs, you count the number of outputs, you count the number of holes, and then it will be like this. So that's something you can show, and then you have actually these two rules to see what you do with the holes. This tells you what happens with a hole, and this tells you what happens in a hole in the other case. Like in one case, in this case, the holes just go away, they become the identity. So then you get the spider theorem, which a lot of people have heard me talk about. That you can actually represent all these guys by spiders and they compose in a certain way. Now, if you got this one, it does something weird. If you have a hole, it sort of splits up. Right? And then you get the new spider theorem. Like, if these guys just shake hands without a hole, they fuse together. if they shake hands and there is a hole in the middle, they sort of completely fall apart. You can show that. Which is a completely different topological behavior. So, just for those who've never seen this, the calculus you get for these commutative Frobenius algebras is very simple, because there is not a lot of possibilities. They always, you can always show that they always look the same and only depend on the number of inputs and outputs. But however you combine these guys, these kind of axioms they make, that you can always rewrite everything in everything else, provided it's connected. Provided it's connected and the number of inputs are equal to the number of outputs. So you've got very little degrees of freedom. And that's why we write these things as spiders. Because there is only one for each number of input and output. And then you can show that the composition rule is if so two of these spiders meet, well, they just become a new one. Is that? But then the funny thing is that because of this W behavior, in the case that they meet in two legs, they fall apart.
Measure a qubit with a set of mistakes,
right? This is already quite far away from such an intuition now.
So it's more than that?
This means if you take the GHZ state, you take GHZ state. So here I've got four systems now. One, I don't care in which state it is. I measure the two first one together with this one. It's like a little bit like teleportation, but a bit more complex. Then this gives me this. Then the result of this will mean there is no information from here going there at all, because it's disconnected.
Sorry, I'm confused. A W state.
This is W state, yeah. Did I say GHZ?
Yeah.
Oh, sorry. This is W. Well, okay. This is not really the W one. It turns out this is the W with the zeros and one exchanged. That's kind of... So you've got this very simple algebraic calculus which characterizes W states completely. This is an equivalent definition, by the way. Yeah?
So I can see how your diagram on the left would fall into two pieces, but I don't understand why it falls into a separate piece for every input and for every output. Can you...
So the key property is this actually, that you can, so if a dot comes into a co-multiplication, this is something you can easily show, then you just get this, like usual. If such a thing comes in, then it splits up. Why? I can quickly make a proof. And then you see immediately that it's going to just further and further split up. Let me just quickly show this. So if I've got this, so I've got a circle here, so I can sort of stick the circle in the middle here basically. See, this is just, I can't get rid of, I can do all my rewrites, but I can't get rid of those. So I take one here instead, and I take one there. And this middle bit just splits up. In one like this, and say, one like this, you see? So it just like falls apart completely. So it's really radically different topological behavior. I'm sorry, it's time.
Well, you have another 5 minutes.
So we got
these two algebraic structures. Well, almost the same, with this tiny bit of difference. One characterizes GHZ's log, the other YW. So we've got a characterization of tripartite and Dankl states in algebraic terms with a graphical calculus. Now, what happens if these two things interact? Now, what do I mean by interacting? Well, if you let GHZ states interact with themselves, and that's actually what I was showing here, then you get sort of n cubic generalization, the same for W. Now, how in mathematics do we see other examples of interaction? Well, if you have a plus, you can do plus, but if you've got plus and time, you can generate polynomials, right? And they typically interact via distributive law, and the exponential interconverts them. So there is some relation between them. It turns out that if you take... So basically, I was showing that these dots, these Frobenius algebras, correspond to bases. If you take, for example, the 0, 1 basis and the plus-minus basis, you can show that you can produce all graph states. So I'm not expecting you to understand this, but those who have seen people talk about the green and these red dots, then if you take these green dots and these red dots, I'm just going to now use orange and blue, because the green is not green and red, but okay. Then, and you start combining them like this. It's a bit different than graph state notation, because I always have to sort of have some loose ends to denote where my qubits are. Then this would be a graph state, like this would be a typical graph state with these alternating colors. So you see, by making them interact, you get more interesting states. So the question is now, if we just start combining the open and the closed dots, plug them together, what sort of behaviors can we generate? So you need to have some kind of interaction rule. And so we write down the following. We say we're going to assume, like for example here, the plus and times are not random operations. You know, they have distributive law which connect them, right? And these are not just two random bases. They are complementary. And that's sort of, so is there a way we can pick like a white beats meaning a GHZ, which was my white again? Yeah, GHZ, and a black being the W, which stand in a special relation so that they interact very nicely with each other. And it turns out if you take the standard GHZ state and the standard W state, then they satisfy the following equations, it turns out. See, I'm not talking in terms of their algebra, not in terms of the states anymore. We know that there is such an algebra for all of these states. And I define the stick to be, you remember, this was just the Bell, this was just the Bell state, but this was like 0, 1, 1, 0. So if you compose them, you get the NOT gate. You get the NOT gate. So this is not a trivial gate. This is like the identity. If you then ask, for example, that the NOT gate commutes with this GHZ dot, which is easily seen that it does because it corresponds to the 0, 1 basis. And if this black dot is copied, which it is, because did I write down what it was? Okay, so this is the 0, and this turns out to be the 1. This turns out to be the 1 state. It's, of course, copied by the GHZ basis. Then, and then you can actually show from all this together that these guys up there are also copied, because they actually correspond with the 0 state. You can, so these axioms imply that. And the theorem you can to show, well, the correspondence is that the structural points of W, which is this, and this, are copyable points of the GHZ state as a consequence of this. As you can, so basically, if I pick a white dot and I require these axioms, then it uniquely defines a black dot, and vice versa. In the same way, this, if you give me an addition, then the exponential tells you what the multiplication is. So these are rules which connect GHZ behavior to W behavior in a unique way. So they're actually much simpler than the stuff you see there. But, right. So to end, so this structure which I write with these interaction rules, and like you get a graphical calculus, you can use your spider rules, you can all use this stuff. Then you can show, basically, I don't have time, but we have a paper, that for every known SLOC superclass, you can just construct examples in this language. So I don't know whether you know what SLOC superclasses are, but like these SLOC classes are continuous. And some people who have tried to classify them, they usually come up with natural sort of clusters of similar states. And we just have started to build them with this language. Here are a bunch of examples of radically different multipart entangled states. And we can even simulate complete superclasses and stuff like that. So basically, this is MSc student work to come up with like a bunch of horrible, I don't know. But the thing, that's what I mean by a compositional paradigm. You start plugging these white and these black things together, and we start to discover lots and lots of crazy multipart entangled states which completely behave differently than the stuff people are working with. So it's, in a way, a generalization of graph states. And the reason it's really a generalization of graph states is because if this is a complementary dot to your GHZ state, say the GHZ in plus and minus, then you can build it from the W state like this. So basically, you can produce graph states with this language, but a lot more. So it's sort of a finer paradigm, and that's where I wanted to end. Like, and which seems to indicate that this mathematical structure of this GHZW duality, we still have to learn a lot from that, seems to be structurally more foundational than complementarity. Because you can just produce so much more. We have the result that you can write down any multipartite state actually using white dots, black dots, and single qubit states. You can write down any linear map, anything. So it's very powerful as an expressive thing. Okay, yeah, that's it.
So, have you thought how in this framework the entanglement weaknesses for genuine multipartite
entanglement? No, a funny thing is, like in Oxford, there is something like transfer theories. Like a PhD student, after a year, he has to write a report. And like this guy I did this work with just was five by Vladko Velda also. But I wasn't there, so I assume entanglement weakness must have come up.
So for the copyable points of the GHZ, there is this nice interpretation of coherent copying of the
Nice.
Is there something similar for the structural point of W?
For
is
there W?
Is there some operational interpretation of this structural point?
That's probably what made it hard to come up with it, because we really haven't got a clue. So I thought I understood this Frobenius algebras, like these copyable things. Mm-hmm. But like one of the key features is that we've got, like, what, for example, a not normal basis arises when this monoid and this cobanoid are each other's adjoints. Then you get an orthonormal basis. You can show that in W cases, two things can't be the adjoint of each other. Mm-hmm. So they're very different. Here they relate like with a NOT gate. We have no intuition whatsoever, but we have this representation result that on qubits there are only two kinds of algebras. The ones which correspond to this GHZ, this copying type of things, and something else, which is the W one. And it's a weird one. It's an equivalent algebraic, it's like the other algebraic structure, which we don't understand very well. It's the only other on a qubit. So it's an interesting, I'm sure nobody, and people who have been working with Frobenius algebras, they've never seen this thing about this circle splitting up in two. They've never seen this. So it's a completely new algebraic concept coming from quantum information.
Another question. Do you know how these things relate to tensor categories?
When you formulate these in tensor, when I was...
So this is some tensor category.
Oh yeah,
I recognize that the
three is part of it. I forgot to erase some reference to it when I was planning. But these things naturally, these are like internal structures in tensor categories. So all the definition which I formulate about cobanoid, these things are naturally formulated within any tensor category. Like for this story, it was only important to talk about Hilbert spaces and linear map. Now, if you go to other tensor categories, it's not clear what these GHZ states are.
Right.
And then maybe there might be others, because the results which I said, there is only two kinds of algebras, that's specifically for Hilbert spaces. So in more general tensor category, it could be different. We don't know.
Sorry, I have one question. So when somehow we construct the representative of, say,
four qubit,
and you can just build up from small things and the bigger one. But do you have any upper bound for such things, or do you can somehow build up as much as you want?
You mean how big you can construct?
Yeah, it seems that you can somehow build up.
I don't see any reason why you would stop. The thing is, it becomes very, although it's a simple computational paradigm, it can become very complicated. So that's why you would like to have some software that does it for you, and then starts to implement the algebraic rewrite. So we actually built, like, Ross Duncan and Alex Kissinger and some other guys, we have such a software, but specifically for complementary observables. So we have to change it now to reason in terms of WGHZ duality kind of calculus, which is it's a completely new kind of thing. So I haven't seen it in this kind of tensor category kind of quantum algebra world. This is a new structure, really, this W stuff. It's a new thing.
I think the relevant question is also the, when somehow people try to classify such things using the LCC, people also consider the polynomial invariance in writing down
right.
The computer basis. Basically, this is the old hierarchy of the polynomial invariance, somehow classified for states. Do you have any connection?
We haven't found that. It's very recent work, so no, but you're right. But this is usually for log that people do it, isn't it? Yeah. No, we're still like trying to explore now connections to other things. We haven't.
Okay.
So one of the nice things is because you got this careful calculus, it will tell you what these states are good for, too. Because you can sort of start plugging things in and see how they behave.
And you can see whether the information is transferred.
Yeah. And now the topology is going to control all of that. The topological change depending whether you plug in. So the big, it's a very important thing that if you plug in one of these. So this is like a very. Intuitively, where is it? This is like the key thing. That if you stick in this state, so topology chain, connectedness stays, stick in this state, connectedness breaks. That's sort of very intuitive to design behaviors using these states. It's sort of like a control button you have. Because this guy and this guy are orthogonal. It's sort of control button you have to control behaviors.
Okay.
So your last comment was that there's this asymmetry between complementarity and this algebraic structure. The algebraic structure implies complementarity, but not vice versa.
Right.
So I wonder if that's connected with another asymmetry, which is that if you have a theory that is non-local and contextual, then it has to have complementarity, but not vice versa. So I can write down a theory that has complementarity, like my toy theory, but there's no Bell inequality violations. But if I have a theory that has Bell inequality violations, say PR box type correlations, then it's a logical contradiction to imagine that you could measure either one of two variables simultaneously. So is that the kind of complementarity you mean? Like, what's the precise content of the statement that you have complementarity? You mean that there exists? When you say a theory has complementarity, is that connected with the statement that you can't measure these two observables?
No, what I call complementarity is really what actually applies to the toy theory, is that you got two Frobenius algebras which stand to each other in a certain way, from which you can prove a bunch of stuff. But like you say, you cannot have hidden variable theory for that. So the question here would be, could you have hidden variable theory when you got these two guys around? I don't know. I don't have a clue, actually.
Well, if you have the GHZ structure and you've got the not gate, you can embed that within the category you call stab.
Yeah.
So you don't even need the W structure, it seems. Or you get the W structure as soon as you've got that not gate, which is one of the polys. Isn't that right?
The W structure doesn't live in stab, right? So you have to go outside.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
No. It's not very intuitive at the moment, this W, because we don't have a lot about it, but it's a canonical thing. It's just out there in algebra for very good reasons. And something we need to understand, which is very different from anything. Like GHZ is very close to the vector space way of thinking. The base W, something else. No clue.
Is there any question? Otherwise, let's thank once again, people.
Thank you.